Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
That's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And continuing with the headlines, there's trouble on Main Street.
The bankers inside here are responsible for the crisis. They're getting rewarded while the people who are the victims of this crisis are being punished by losing the places that they have to live.
Voices from an organized protest outside the Mortgage Bankers Convention in San Francisco on October 21st, that was yesterday. Main Street's traumas really extend to homeowners who are concerned about losing their homes because either they've gone underwater or they've actually had their houses foreclosed on. As the financial crisis ripples its way through the economy, we wanted to check with our friend and New York Times columnist David Leonhard, who writes for the paper's Economix blog. Where on Main Street is the tsunami beginning to hit? David, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, as always, John.
And let's deconstruct the category of people who are mortgage holders or tentative mortgage holders. Who's most vulnerable and who has the federal government offered, at least in theory, a helping hand to?
And I think that's right. That's really important to distinguish between, you use the plural categories, and there really are two main categories, and I think we often lose sight of that. So the first category of homeowners who are in trouble are people who are going to have trouble making their mortgage payments. And maybe they took out a mortgage that they were never, ever able to be able to afford. Maybe they took out one of these adjustable rate mortgages that has a balloon payment, and they're not going to be able to afford that. Or maybe when they took out their mortgage, they could afford it, but since then they've lost their job or lost some significant number of hours on their job. That's the first category. Those people literally can't stay in their homes in that they can't make their payments without some sort of adjustment. The second category is a little different. It's people who can make their monthly payments but are underwater in the language of housing, which means that their house has fallen by so much in value that it's now worth less than their mortgage. They can stay in their houses. Many of them will. Their kids like the schools. They like their neighborhoods. But some number of them won't because they look at their house more as an investment than as a place to live, and they'll say, wait a second, I'm making monthly payments on an investment that's never going to pay off. And as we think about how to rescue homeowners, which seems to be in the air right now, I think it's important to keep those two groups separate in our minds.
Well, as an economist, as someone who writes about these kinds of programs, and you have Senator McCain talking about an additional mortgage bailout plan from the federal government should he be elected president, which group is more deserving, in your view, of federal assistance?
Well, I would say, to me, the first group is certainly more deserving. I mean, people who are able to stay in their homes but may choose to leave because they don't like the returns they're getting, there's a word for that, and it's a speculator. It's not traditionally what we think of as a speculator, but that's really what people are doing. Now, I realize there are exceptions. I mean, if you imagine someone who had to move in order to be with a sick relative, they wouldn't be a speculator. And if they couldn't sell their house because they were underwater, that'd be a significant problem and hardship. The real issue we face with coming up with some kind of homeowner bailout, I mean, you often hear it's time to help Main Street. It's nearly impossible to solve the foreclosure problem and prevent all these foreclosures without ending up helping huge numbers of people who don't need help. Because if you think about it, if you're one of those homeowners who can stay in your home and is going to, and I'm one of those ones who looks at my underwater mortgage and says, I'm out of here, as soon as the government comes to give me help, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to say, actually, I'm also one of those people who's going to leave my home.
But David, isn't that a greater good argument? Because, I mean, the bottom line is we're spending billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars on helping to study the banking industry, and there are lots of executives who are still going to benefit from that.
Absolutely. I think there are two things here. I mean, your point is basically, look, we're kind of beyond the point where we're drawing fine moral distinctions about who deserves help and who doesn't. We're trying to do things to prop up the economy, and if some homeowners get help who maybe don't deserve it so much, then they probably deserve it more than Wall Street does. I get that argument. The problem is there are also a lot of people who deserve it even more than those homeowners, and I'm wondering why we're not helping them.
Like the people of the auto industry, who, if Kirk Kerkorian is pulled pulled out of Ford may lose their jobs if the auto industry sort of goes away. Well, as far as the moral distinctions are concerned, though, Dorey yesterday spoke with financial advisor, the economic advisor to the McCain campaign, and he made this argument that we're going to be able to sort out the difference between people who lied on their mortgages and who didn't, the sort of 10 million mortgage holders who are in trouble, and help the ones who are honest and not help the ones who were dishonest. But isn't that sort of a complete distortion of the problem? I mean, it's conceivable that every one of the 10 million lied to get their mortgage. That's the problem here.
Well, I didn't hear the interview, but to me, it's right. It's not just that it's going to be hard to figure out who lied. It's also that some people told the truth but had fabulously unrealistic expectations because banks were giving out loans to people who, even if they told the truth, weren't going to be able to afford their mortgage. And people were saying, oh, but it's not a problem because my house is going to go up so much in value that even if I don't come into some windfall or get a raise, I'll be able to just sell my house and make a profit. So I agree. There's no easy way to sort through the worthy and the unworthy. We're going to have to help some number of people who maybe aren't unworthy, but I think we're going to have to also stop short of helping everyone who's worthy, because doing that would end up being massively expensive. And it's not clear to me that homeowners should necessarily be first in line above, say, someone who rents and loses their job.
Finally, you write, and for the Sunday Magazine this week, you write about people who have had a certain level of assumptions in their retirement strategies, one of which you've already mentioned, and that is that my house's value is going to rise forever and ever and ever. And all of a sudden, those assumptions have gone by the wayside. What others besides my house will always increase in value are suddenly looking a little ridiculous now?
Well, my favorite is the savings rate. I mean, the savings rate in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s was 9%. It meant we put away 9 cents on every dollar we earned. It fell to 5% in the 90s, and it's basically fallen to zero in the last few years. And that's sort of this assumption that, oh, I don't need to save money because the money I've already saved will do so wonderfully well. That's not the only thing going on. It's also an issue of the fact that income growth has been so slow makes it harder for people to save. But you can't really survive as a society for any long period of time with a savings rate of 1%, which is what we've had in the current decade. And to me, that's something that's going to have to change.
Again, it's about speculators versus savers.
1%. Well, just very quickly before we got to go, but you said others should be helped, perhaps the person who loses their job and is renting. But is it a moral question, David? Or are we really talking about an economic functionality question? And which dollar is going to be better spent in getting consumers to have more money in their pocket to go out and spend and get this economy going?
I think help to a homeowner or to an unemployed renter both of those forms of help would have some economic benefit. So I do think it's okay to keep in mind not only the economic punch of the stimulus, but also who is deserving of stimulus and who really needs it. To me, people who are in their homes and can afford their mortgage payments, but may be upset about the fact they're underwater, would be behind in line people who can't make their mortgage payments or people who lose their jobs through no fault of their own.
Stimulus, morality, and getting the economy moving again. Interesting issues. David Leonhardt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
New York Times columnist who writes the paper's new Economics blog. Spoke with us from Washington, D.C.
Always gets us thinking. We're always on here at The Takeaway, and we're conducting an American exit poll. Have you voted early, and why did you do it? Tell us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE, and here's your takeaway.
Farm families are getting split up over the health care issue. They're having to move to town, one of the spouses, so that they can get health insurance and keep their farms.
That's Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein reporting from Colorado and talking to ranchers in that potential swing state.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
And I'm Adora Udoji.